Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast series, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federal Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group is hosting a debate on the War on Terror trials. As always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. My name is Dean Reuter. I'm Vice President and Director of the Federal Society's Practice Groups, and I'm happy to welcome you to our podcast today. We're joined today by Baker & Hostetler partner David Rifkin and Andrew McCarthy, co-chair of the Center for Law and Counterterrorism. Both are frequently published in several national media outlets. Indeed, it is their written exchange on this topic that has spurred this podcast. Links to those written materials and the written debate can be found on the Federalist Society website at www.fed-soc.org. We're going to begin today's podcast with a round of opening remarks and then have some general discussion. We're going to hear first from Mr. McCarthy and then from Mr. Rifkin. Mr. McCarthy?
Good morning, Dean. Good morning, David. It's a pleasure to be here again, and it's an especial pleasure to be here with my friend David Rifkin. Dean mentioned that I'm the co-director of the Center for Law and Counterterrorism at FDD. My co-director is David Rifkin, and I'm delighted by that because he's a good friend and one of the best lawyers I know, which was why I was moved to disagree with him on a matter of, I think, some importance, which goes to our policy with respect to enemy combatants. And not to put words in David's mouth, I think we're probably in the same place from a policy standpoint, which is to say, I think that if we had our druthers, the enemy combatants would be handled by military commission, which is the system I think we think properly that President Bush put in place when we went into a war paradigm after 9/11, and is really a policy that was affirmed by Congress in 2006, in particular, with the Military Commissions Act, and really reaffirmed by the Obama administration in 2009 when it joined with a substantially Democratic Congress and did some tweaks with the military commissions, but otherwise left them in place. Our disagreement is about the constitutionality of what the president's law enforcement mission is, and to be more concrete about that, the Congress has made a provision in the Defense Appropriations Act which prevents the, or at least purports to prevent the executive branch from bringing alien enemy combatants into the United States from Guantanamo Bay. It uses its power of the purse to accomplish that. It won't give funding for that purpose. And David has argued, and I agree, that one of the principal purposes for that provision is to prevent the enemy combatants currently detained at Guantanamo Bay from being given civilian trials, that is, from being given all of the rights of the American citizens that they are pledged to kill in a civilian trial, as opposed to the more limited set of rights that they would get in a military commission. David's made the argument that there is a constitutional problem with what Congress has done in that regard, and that is because, as I understand it, he regards prosecution as a core duty of the executive branch. I was quite surprised to see that argument because when the executive branch first began under our constitutional system, prosecution was not one of its tasks, and indeed there was not even a Department of Justice in our system for about a century after the Constitution was adopted. The framers of our Constitution assumed and assured the public in the ratification debates about the Constitution that prosecution was going to be one of the roles that was maintained by the states in our system. The only reason that we have federal prosecutions are because of acts of Congress. The ability of prosecutors, of federal prosecutors, to bring cases is completely dependent on Congress enacting statutes and not only creating the lower federal courts, but giving them the jurisdiction to hear cases. While prosecutors do have discretion, having been a prosecutor for about 20 years in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York, I can tell you that that prosecution is very limited. It really is essentially limited to the decision whether to bring a case or not. And to the extent a prosecutor has discretion, it is completely within the parameters that are set up by Congress. So my only beef with David's position, but I think it's an important one, is that you cannot have a core function of the presidency unless you are talking about a function that the president would have under the Constitution, regardless of whether Congress acted or not, and prosecution is not that sort of a function. So I don't think there's any constitutional problem with what Congress has done. We could argue it all day as a policy matter, although I don't think it'd be much of an argument between David and me.
Thank you, Andy. I also wanted to thank Dean and the Federalist Society for bringing Andy and me together, and indeed we're old friends and colleagues, and we are almost always in accord. And in this instance, we're certainly in accord on all the policy issues involved. There's no question that trying unlawful enemy combatants of any variety, but particularly senior 9/11 related figures in Article III courts would be nothing worse off. Would amount to a disaster from a variety of perspectives. Having said that, to the extent that I believe that the constitutional equities in a situation where they are clearly in play trump policy equities, I feel compelled to respectfully disagree with Andy for a couple of very basic reasons. I believe, and I think framers would have agreed with that, that it's not really, to be clear, we're not talking just about law enforcement in a technical sense, but the president's power, responsibility to take care of it, laws be faithfully executed, that's listed in Section 3 of Article 2, is the core power of the executive, every bit as essential to that core power zone of executive as the president's powers commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy, featured in Section 2, and actually both of those specific examples are a species, a subset of the executive power that's under the vesting clause, featured in Section 1 of Article 2, is entrusted to the president. Now, the way the framers created the Constitution is we don't have hermetically sealed compartments. We have instances where one branch, in this case Congress, operating under Article I, has enormous and nearly absolute power of a purse, which includes the power to fund certain functions and not fund them, and certainly includes the power to prescribe or proscribe executive branch activities for the medium of an appropriation rider, which is a little different from not appropriating money at all. It's equally clear, at least in my mind, that the power to execute the laws faithfully is the core power of the executive and presupposes virtually unfettered exercise of his discretion. In fact, the essence of being an executive is exercising that discretion. If discretion was not necessary, if you could operate on the basis of antecedent laws, there would be no need to have a chief executive. And that, of course, is an old issue that was discussed at great length by the founding generations and certainly even much before and the Constitutional Convention and during the Constitutional Convention and during the ratification debates. So you have situations where one branch exercising its proper constitutional authority, in this case Congress under Article I, is acting in a way that bumps against the authority of another branch, in this case President under Article II, exercising its authority. And there A question of which power gives way is, again, an age-old question. We've been with us as long as we've had this great republic. I think the reasonable principle of reconciling this tension is to say that Congress can certainly nudge, push, squeeze the executive, and there can be a lot of other verbs one can use here, but it cannot impair the ability of executive to discharge its core constitutional authority. Now, Indy has made a number of perfectly correct points that in the first instance, in order for executive to be able to take care to execute the laws faithfully, it's Congress that in the first instance participates in the exercise of promulgating or enacting such laws, although, as we both know, the executive is also a participant in the legislative process. And if indeed if Congress took off the table all of the federal criminal statutes, there would be, at least on a criminal law side, nothing for the executive to take care to execute faithfully. It is also the case that Congress can eliminate the Department of Justice tomorrow and can, you know, shrink the executive branch to the husk of its current size. It can do all of those things. But in the, this area of separation of powers, just because Congress can do the greater does not necessarily mean that it can do the lesser. Just because Congress can proceed in one way and substantially hamstring the executive does not mean it can do in different ways. At the end of the day, Congress can virtually accomplish anything it wants, provided it is willing to exert itself in a certain fashion, in a constitutionally proper fashion, and pay political price for it, because accountability is one of the most overarching constitutional virtues. So Congress can certainly abolish the Department of Justice. Congress can certainly shrink the corpus of federal laws. But whatever laws remain in the books, the president, and to the extent those laws feature the possibility of criminal prosecution, it is entirely up to the president and president alone, because all the executive power is vested in him. And to the extent he delegates some of it to his subordinates, again, it does not mean it's not reposed at his level. To the extent that Congress retains some laws in the book, it is entirely discretionary with the president where and how he would take care of it, those laws be faithfully executed. And the problem with this kind of an appropriation rider is that it would impair that authority on the part of a president, and in my way, in my opinion, in most fundamentally unconstitutional way. And it is that concern and that concern alone that compels me to take the position that this particular appropriation rider is unconstitutional. Now, to clarify, the language that Andy and I are talking about, the appropriations rider, does not specifically talk about prosecutions. And there are a lot of things that Congress, apropos of my sort of organizing principle, that Article 1 can squeeze and push and nudge Article 2, but not completely impair its ability to discharge the core constitutional function. Consistent with that principle, Congress can certainly prohibit funds being spent from changing or enhancing prison facilities in the United States that can be used to house enemy combatants. That does not impair a president's core power. It can certainly prevent the president from using the funds to transport people to be housed or incarcerated here. What it cannot do is prevent the president, if he so decides, completely, foolishly, and erroneously, and which is where Andy and I agree, from trying individuals in Article III courts. The way to deal with this matter would be to have a signing statement where the president would say that he would construe this language, and that's how signing statements work, in ways consistent with his constitutional responsibilities, which would mean, again, that for all other purposes, he cannot spend any money to bring anybody from Guantanamo to the United States except for the purpose of trying them in an Article III court.
Well, let me just say in response, I think David's argument on the core power that he alluded to in his Wall Street Journal op-ed that was, co-written. David, I off the top of my head, I don't remember who your co-author was.
With Lee Casey.
Okay. I think it was a day or two after Christmas, if I'm remembering correctly. But the core power that was identified in the article was the power of prosecution. What he's alluding to in our discussion today is that the power that the or the constitutional directive that the presidency that the laws be faithfully executed. It seems to me that that's something of a circular argument because, number one, what the president has to execute faithfully is the laws, and it's Congress that writes the laws. And what we're dealing with in front of us now in this defense appropriation is a law enacted by Congress, which the president, in fact, has signed. And it seems to me that he doesn't have any less a duty to see that that law is faithfully executed, namely the law that that Congress has enacted that funds not be used for certain prohibited purposes. He's got to see that that law be faithfully executed as much as he has to see that any other law be faithfully executed. And whether to bring a prosecution under a statute or not is not a matter of seeing that the laws be faithfully executed. That's a matter of prosecutorial discretion. If you took the logical extension of David's argument, a president would have the duty to prosecute any time there was a crime committed in order to make sure the laws are faithfully executed. And as we all know, that's not the case. Prosecutors actually have discretion whether to execute the law or not in those circumstances. So I don't think he can get away from the fact that the core power that he has identified is the power of prosecution. And prosecution simply is not a core power of the presidency. We're actually in an area where if you're going to measure the interest of the branches, the relative interest of the branches involved, Congress really is the one whose core responsibilities are being affected here. It's Congress which determines what the qualifications are for aliens to enter into the United States. The executive branch cannot and could not, despite the president's paramountcy in foreign affairs, the president couldn't determine unilaterally which aliens got to enter the United States and which didn't. That would require an act of Congress. A president, if he wanted to prosecute an enemy combatant and Congress hadn't given him a statute to do that, a president couldn't do that. He'd be reliant on Congress. He's reliant on Congress to create the courts and the jurisdiction in those courts in order to prosecute. If Congress were to enact a law tomorrow that said that the federal district courts no longer have jurisdiction to try cases against enemy combatants, leaving the president only the Military Commissions Act to rely on, the president would have to comply with that. That would be the way that the laws would be faithfully executed. So I don't see how it is that the fact that there are criminal laws on the books and that they would be cognizable if you could get defendants here within the jurisdiction of the court, and therefore I don't see that that attaching to that is the constitutional mandate that the presidency that the laws be faithfully executed. He'd still have to have a paramount constitutional authority, given that Congress has spoken on the question of who gets to come into the country, and I just don't see that David has identified one.
Right. Well, Andy has made a couple of points. First, of course, the point being that if Congress passes this appropriations rider in the context of a defense spending bill is a specie of law and has every bit as much dignity as any other federal law. Why shouldn't the president just comply with it, consistent with his obligation to take care of it, the laws are faithfully executed? With respect, that point is easily answered. For a long, long time, the chief executives and the legal advisors have taken the position that statutes are secondary in their legal dignity, if you will, to the Constitution, and any statute that is inconsistent with the Constitution. Not only does not compel the president to do anything, but can be ignored, does not even have to be vetoed, is void ab initio, and there's a great deal of Office of Legal Counsel learning over the years and decades on the question of the president's not only the right, but the duty to disregard unconstitutional statutes. So that argument doesn't take us where I think Andy would like us to be. Now, the second argument, of course, is the more difficult one. His point, again, is that the power to engage in criminal law enforcement is not a core power of the executive. My response to that is, again, to observe that criminal laws are a species of broader set of laws enacted by Congress. The president has both a constitutional duty as well as a constitutional right to faithfully execute such laws. That means, in the context of his discretion as the chief executive, that what it means to execute them faithfully, particularly in the context of criminal laws, entails the exercise of prosecutorial discretion, which Congress can absolutely not impair or eliminate. Congress cannot tell the president what cases to try, what defendants to try or not to try. Respect, under the logic that Andy has adduced, Congress can, in effect, micromanage the president's law enforcement power through the medium of appropriation riders in ways that would produce an absolutely disharmonious effects and, in effect, make the president an agent of Congress in this enormously important sphere. Let's consider it for a second. Congress can pass appropriation riders that would prohibit any funds from being spent to prosecute any member of Congress, House or the Senate. It can pass a rider that would prohibit the president or any other federal officer from prosecuting a subset of individuals or any particular person who, in effect, at least for purposes of federal law, would be absolutely immune from any investigation or prosecution. And to the extent that the power of enforcing the law, particularly criminal law, is the most formidable power that government can bring to bear upon individuals, that would make Congress not a co-equal branch, but make Congress clearly superior to the president. Now, the third point that Andy made, which again we're discussing in the first round, is what Congress can do all those other things. With respect, I reiterate my original point. Congress can pretty much accomplish its will, provided it goes about it in a constitutionally permissible fashion. Congress can abolish, indeed, all federal criminal statutes under which the president, using the greatest creativity at his disposal, could prosecute unlawful enemy combatants. If that were to happen, there would be absolutely no loss for the president to take care to faithfully execute. And the path of trying enemy combatants in Article III courts would be completely foreclosed. That would be a very difficult step for Congress to take, and the one for which they pay an enormous political price. Congress can indeed abolish all federal courts, in which case, of course, you can have, since state courts are bound to apply federal law, there are some difficult questions whether or not federal officers can prosecute federal offenses in state courts. Congress can try to, as Andy pointed out, do a jurisdiction withdrawal type approach. As a matter of fact, however, I point out that a great deal of post 9/11 litigation, the courts have resisted the jurisdiction withdrawal statutes, and even long before 9/11, precisely to which illustrates precisely the point I'm trying to make, that in the structural separation of powers area, just because Congress can do something In a kind of a total and absolute and clumsy and politically costly way, does not mean it can do something lesser in a clever and not particularly accountable way. So, yes, you can abolish all of our federal courts. You can, of course, not abolish the Supreme Court. Yes, you can abolish the Department of Justice. You can do many other things. But in the end of the day, neither branch can act in a way that can impede the ability of a branch to discharge its core functions. And with respect, the reason I kept talking about the duty to execute the laws faithfully and not just in terms of law enforcement, because law enforcement is a subset of its broader responsibility. And once Congress passes a given statute that is being enforced with discretion, civil or criminal, the discretion absolutely belongs with no reservation to the president and president only, not to the prosecutors who do work for the president. And there's absolutely nothing Congress can do about it. And the only proper way for Congress to change this equation is to abolish the statute in issue.
Well, I feel sort of like we're going around in a circle here, but let me just respond to a couple of things. Number one, we don't have any dispute that statutes are secondary to the Constitution in terms of their, the pecking order of law. But their statutes are secondary only when you can identify a core power of the executive branch that's being encroached upon by the statute. And again, what David is saying is that the power of prosecution is a core power of the presidency that can't be encroached upon. That would have been quite surprising to the framers, who didn't expect the executive branch of the United States government, as opposed to the state governments, was going to be executing any prosecutorial authority whatsoever. Again, you cannot have a core power of the presidency if it is a power that requires an act of Congress to activate it. And prosecution simply is not that. Secondly, I think David has a very overblown idea of what prosecutorial discretion is. Perhaps, not having been in the position of having to exercise that sort of discretion, he's not familiar with how much Congress, in fact, does micromanage the prosecutorial activities of the executive branch. But the only discretion that the executive branch has in terms of prosecution is the choice of whether to charge and what charges to bring. And those choices are completely circumscribed by statutory law. So that, for example, if a president decides that he wants to bring a case in X federal court, and it turns out that the statute of limitations has run, the fact that the president wants to bring a prosecution and wants to execute the laws faithfully by doing that is overtaken by the fact that he can't bring it because Congress has defined the statutory term within which the case can be brought. If the president wants to bring a case in a court that does not have jurisdiction to try the case, because Congress hasn't given it jurisdiction to try the case, that is a non-starter. He can't do it. The Congress almost completely does micromanage the executive branch in terms of prosecutorial activity, to the point that for about the first century after the Constitution was adopted, the executive branch and presidents and attorneys general wanted expanded responsibilities, asked Congress for expanded responsibilities, asked Congress for funding for a Justice Department or something like it, and were turned down. There were no prosecutorial activities of the executive branch until about 1870, when Congress decided to give presidents that authority. And that authority completely is a creature of statute and totally under the control of the Congress. And
yeah,
as far as the jurisdictional limitations are concerned, let's remember what the jurisdictional argument's been about and what it hasn't been about. What the courts have done in sweeping aside the jurisdictional limitations that Congress tried to enact in the Detainee Treatment Act and in the Military Commissions Act was find that enemy combatants had rights under the Constitution. Now, I think I thought that was a profoundly incorrect set of decisions for the court to make. I think David probably agrees with me about that. But that was not a matter of separation of powers. It was not a question of the court saying that the executive branch had some enhanced authority that we hadn't heard about before. That was a finding that the defendants or the claimants in question, the enemy combatants, had a constitutional right to petition the courts of the United States, and therefore that the court's jurisdiction could not be circumvented in a way that denied the enemy combatants the right to come into federal court. That was not in any way an enhancement of the executive branch's authority to conduct cases irrespective of whether Congress gave them statutory authority or not.
Let me respond briefly, and let me tackle the second issue first because it's the easiest. Andy is absolutely right that the constitutional basis on which the courts have resisted the jurisdiction of withdrawal provisions in several statutes, including the Detainee Treatment Act, was not predicated upon separation of powers. It was predicated upon, and I also agree with Andy, it was utterly misguided decisions, the court's view of the individual liberty allegedly vested under the Constitution in the defendants. However, the reason I was citing this is to underscore a broader point, namely Congress has authority under Article 1 to, quite aside from appropriations power, nearly absolute power to prescribe rules for the conduct and regulation of a government, which includes the power to create and abolish executive departments, to assign specific responsibilities to portions therein, to create and abolish courts and reassign jurisdiction. And all is trying to demonstrate that power is, Article 1 of power is exercised in subordination to some other important constitutional equities. Incorrectly, I think both Andy and I would agree, in the post 9/11 jurisprudence, but nevertheless, it is so exercised. Now, I think we hopefully can come to grips where I think Andy and I really disagree, but perhaps because I've not made my case well. So let me try to say it again. I am not claiming that the president has inherent law enforcement authority. Far from it. Indeed, it would it be entirely constitutionally appropriate for Congress to abolish all federal criminal laws, not have a single one, in which case there would be nothing for the president to exercise his discretion regard to enforcing such body of law, and nothing to faithfully execute. And indeed, as far as all the elements of various statutory offenses, civil and criminal, including statutes of limitations, including who can be judged, including, again, in consistent with some fundamental constitutional principles, but you could certainly have a lot of congressional decisions driving such things as evidentiary rules, and a myriad of other things that bear upon the execution of the laws. Congress can do all of that. But the fundamental principle here is that Congress has to take the presidency as the framers created it. Once Congress has enacted, with the president participating in this process, a given statute that envisions that particular conduct is liable to be charged as a federal offense, how to proceed and set up other things that Andy described, including statute of limitations, venue provisions, et cetera, et cetera. Once that is done, all the decisions from that point in time are entirely the president's. Now, that is the case not only in this area. This is a case in another area, which I think Andy and I have historically agreed quite often, which is why I'm a little surprised, Andy, when you say, well, how can it be a core aspect of executive power in Article 2 that you need congressional action? Let me just try to demonstrate that the same synergy, if you will, of taking the president as you find it, applies on the foreign policy side. The president absolutely is the commander-in-chief, both because of our language in Section 2, but also because of the vesting clause. And yet, if Congress does not appropriate any money to create the Army and the Navy, president is virtually bereft of any tools to wage war. Congress can do that. It would be extremely foolhardy, but it's a constitutional matter. Congress can do that. But once Congress has created the Army and the Navy and prescribed in some broad general ways the rules for their conduct. Then the principle of taking the president as you find him and letting him be the commander-in-chief and exercise his full discretion on issues wherever you use air power, which theater of operations you operate, what forces you deploy there, how you prosecute the word of victory is entirely up to the president. The same, absolutely the same logic applies in the area of faithfully executing the law covered by Section 3. And the subset of that is the prosecutorial discretion. So under Andy's approach, there's really Congress can micromanage the president in a variety of areas in ways which we all would find troubling. But to extend, we can maybe another back and forth. Let me just exercise the prerogative of asking Andy a question. What is the limiting principle on the congressional ability to disable the president from executing a given statute faithfully? Not abolishing the statute, but just disabling a particular approach to its execution by saying no money shall be spent, you know, prosecuting David Rifkin and Andy McCarthy, therefore making us virtually immune from federal law. Or back to my point about saying no money shall be spent to prosecute any member of Congress under any federal statute. What is the fundamental difference between what we're talking about here and my hypothetical?
I guess as far as the question about what would be the limiting principle that would, do I take you to be saying stop Congress from enacting that sort of law?
Yes. What is the distinction between the rider you find palatable here and my hypothetical rider, which would say you cannot prosecute any member of Congress, and you can even list a specific litany of federal statutes.
I don't think there is any constitutional problem with that kind of a statute. It would be a profound political problem, and I think. The Congress that enacted such a stupid law would probably pay the price for it politically. But constitutionally, I don't think anything would prevent Congress from enacting a law like that. I guess I'd have to run it through the system and try to decide if there was an equal protection problem with it. But I don't.
We're talking about respect structural. I mean, leave equal protection. Equal protection. Let's not worry about equal protection analysis, but I mean, let's focus on the structure matter. I'll just say briefly, Andy, the following, that not only the problem with this arrangement, and I know reductio ad absurdum is not always the best way of arguing, but the fundamental problem with this arrangement is not only that it would emasculate the ability of a president to exercise his core authority relative to faithfully executing the law, but it would put Congress, Congress in effect in a position of undue power vis-a-vis the president, because Congress would be able.
Which core authority?
What is the definition in your book of a term to execute the laws faithfully? Because in my book, executing the laws faithfully is both a president's duty, but also his right. Executing laws faithfully presupposes discretion. The key discretionary decision at the front end in both criminal and civil statutes is whether or not to prosecute, i.e. try to punish, a given set of individuals. And if you take that choice away from the president, then his power to execute the laws faithfully means absolutely nothing.
Well, I think that to execute the laws faithfully simply means to carry out your powers within the parameters of the law, meaning the Constitution. But if you're going to have a collision between the power of Congress and the power of the president, you have to identify an actual power of the presidency. I assume that the powers of the presidency have to be executed in a way that is lawful, whether it is with fidelity to the Constitution or fidelity to the statutes that are in question. But when constitutional powers collide, what we generally look at is what is the power that Congress is asserting and what is the power that the president is asserting. And what we have here is Congress is using its power of the purse. You're saying that that interferes with the president's prosecutorial discretion. The Congress's power of the purse is constitutional. The president's prosecutorial discretion in the domestic criminal justice system is a creature of statute. So on the test that you laid out before, you know, statutes being secondary to the Constitution, what we're dealing with here is Congress flexing its constitutional muscles in a way that interferes with the president's statutory authority. I think it's the president that needs to bow back. And, you know, to the extent that you compare this to, for example, the president's commander-in-chief power, his other ability to conduct foreign affairs, now you're talking about a completely different ambit of presidential responsibility and constitutional authority. You and I have both together cited the cases back when we were working together on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, in which the Supreme Court has acknowledged that the president has power that is almost unilateral completely in the realm of foreign affairs. So, for example, Congress has attached also to this Defense Appropriations Act a rider which I believe lays out conditions that other countries are supposed to be able to, or metrics that other countries are supposed to be able to meet before the president would have authority to transfer an enemy combatant from Guantanamo Bay to one of those countries. If you were going to argue that that provision of the rider to the or that rider to the Defense Appropriations Bill was unconstitutional, I would agree with you wholeheartedly. Because
I would, by the way, Andy, I would. Let me just say very very briefly, and I apologize because I think again it's useful to our listeners to after several rounds to really crystallize our disagreement. It's not the power. The president has no inherent power of criminal law enforcement or prosecutorial discretion. The president has the core power of executive to faithfully execute the laws with proviso that the substantive definitions and a variety of other things relating to what those laws are is driven by Congress with the president's involvement. If you look at the language in Section 2 and Section 3, they're almost mirror images of each other. The president shall be the commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy in Section 2. The president shall take care of it, that the laws be faithfully executed. All I'm saying, and it's to me a rather unremarkable observation, that in both instances, once Congress has given the president a certain set of tools, military forces, statutes, and laws, how the president proceeds to execute them faithfully is the core power of executive in the same way as the power to wage war or conduct diplomacy is the core power of the president.
All I'm saying in response is that if the president's powers that we're talking about are the laws that Congress has passed, then
Congress can abolish them
if it so chooses.
What it cannot condition with respect, Andy, is how the president proceeds to execute them.
Congress can also pass another law that the president equally has the obligation to faithfully execute. And it's odd to me that you would take a position that the president's power to see that the laws be faithfully executed hinges on his being able to violate a law that Congress has just executed or enacted.
There's a difference. What I'm trying to, and this we had
There's
this.
There's a difference when a statute collides with a core power of the executive branch, and you have yet to be able to cite a core power of the executive branch that this act of Congress interferes with. You're talking about prosecutorial discretion, which, you know, I don't mean to keep beating the dead horse, but it's not a core power of the executive branch.
What is your definition, Andy? Let me just do one more round, and I apologize if we're not ending up in the same place. But Congress can abolish any statute, and once it happens, the president, obviously, there's nothing left of a president's power, president's authority, to execute that statute faithfully. But unless Congress does that, what is the significance of his Section 3 authority?
I think that
in the absence of the abolition of a statute or a new statute that supplants it, how is it Congress can micromanage the president's faithful execution of an existing statute for an appropriations rider? And you're telling me that you don't see what constitutional language we're talking about here?
No, I'm saying that. That the duty to see that the laws be faithfully executed includes all of the laws, including this one. And it's the only way that the statute can be trumped is if it hits into a core power of the presidency. To say that the president has the constitutional obligation to see that the laws be faithfully executed, and that means all the laws except this one, seems to me to be a very strange argument. And let me ask you a question. Let's say that the president decided that in his unquestioned prosecutorial discretion that he wanted to try five of the 9/11 enemy combatants in a single prosecution, and that he did, in fact, bring that prosecution in the federal court in New York, say, and a federal judge decided, well, I think a severance is warranted here, so we'll have five separate trials, which would, of course, interfere with the president's prosecutorial discretion, since the president wanted to have it all as one trial. Do you find that troubling?
No, I do not, largely because I would fall back, Andy, on the principle I articulated in my opening remark, and the same principle applies to interactions between Article 3 and Article 2, every bit as much as the interactions between Article 1 and Article 2. A judicial determination that the five defendants should be tried separately, while it does impact president's prosecutorial discretion, does not vitiate it. It impacts it adversely, and that is permissible. And back to the foreign affairs for a second, consider this. Congress can indeed pass something like UCMJ, Uniform Code of Military Justice, that inhibits in some ways president's ability to prosecute war. It tells the president, for example, that he cannot order troops to violate violate the norms set forth in UCMJ. But both you and I would agree that if Congress passed a statute which says the president cannot use air power in Afghanistan because Congress in its infinite wisdom thinks it's a bad idea because of possibility of civilian damages and collateral damage, that would be an undue vitiation of a president's power as commander-in-chief would be utterly unconstitutional and we void ab initio. So the question always is not whether or not another branch, be it Article 3 or Article 1, is doing something that squeezes or adversely impacts the president's ability to carry out his core constitutional duties, but does it unduly vitiate it?
No,
and I think the answer is it does in this instance.
Identified in that example is a situation in which Congress actually does encroach upon a core power of the executive, that is the commander-in-chief power. I wouldn't make the argument that Congress couldn't enact a statute like that because, you know, there are international laws and the Uniform Code of Military Justice and whatever other laws might apply, and it's up to the president to see that the laws be faithfully executed. I would say instead that you have identified a core power of the executive branch which Congress is unconstitutionally interfering with, and I'd have no problem agreeing that the Congress couldn't do that. But I'm trying to understand your limiting principle because from where I sit, you have no problem with the idea that a court could interfere with the president's prosecutorial discretion by
in certain ways
defendants, but you have a problem with the idea that Congress, which has the power of the purse, can enact a statute that says the president can't bring people into the United States where they would be able to have a civilian trial, particularly under circumstances where Congress has made available to the president if he wants to prosecute and if he wants to see that those laws be faithfully executed, the Military Commissions Act, where he can convene a trial tomorrow if he wants.
Let me just say, in both instances, Article 1 and Article 3 branches can impact and certainly push against the president's prosecutorial discretion. Where I think you and I fundamentally differ is that I view the power to execute the laws faithfully, with a core aspect of that power being discretion to decide whether or not, consistent with the existing statutory framework, to charge somebody and with what, as being at the heart of the power to execute laws faithfully, every bit as much as the president's power to determine whether to use air power, provided Congress gave him some aircraft or other platforms.
Well, I guess, being part and parcel of his... The place that we disagree is, I don't think that the statutory framework is frozen in time. I think that Congress has the power anytime it wishes to.
To abolish it, yes, the framework, but not how the president, what Congress will respond.
A law that changes the statutory framework. I don't see any problem with that. You keep talking about abolish and repeal. I don't think that they need to do that. I think that if Congress passes another law that changes the framework, the president has to faithfully execute that as well. And Congress can do that unless the president can come up with some core power that's being encroached on.
All true, Andy, provided what Congress has really done, and back to the principle that Congress can do almost everything if it's proceeding in a, and I know we sound like we're debating how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, but if Congress wants to change, revise, abolish, amend the statutory framework, that is perfectly fine. Just like if Congress wanted to defund the Army and the Navy, that would be very regrettable, but probably constitutional. What Congress cannot do is micromanage how the president uses the Army and the Navy. What Congress cannot do is micromanage how the president executes the laws faithfully. It is an exactly parallel situation in both instances. It goes to the question of how Congress is trying to accomplish something, not with what is the end result. And here,
I guess where we disagree is what you're talking about now is commander-in-chief power, which actually is a core power of the presidency. But look, we can go around on this a million times.
I agree.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I think this has been a very interesting discussion, and thank you to the listeners for listening. I certainly hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.